As our individual and group development progress, we obey A's traditions for other reasons. We obey them because we think they are right for us. We obey these principles because we think they are good principles, even though we still resist somewhat. Then, in time, comes the final level of obedience, the best of all. We obey AA's 12 traditions because we really want to for ourselves. It is no longer a question of good or whether they are good or bad, or good or bad. We conform because we genuinely want to conform. And such is our process of growth in unity and in function, and such is the evidence of God's grace and love among us. Now, many people ask, many members ask, how can AA function under such seeming anarchy? Other societies have to have law, force, and sanction and punishment administered by authorized people. I'm looking out here and I see one of the loveliest and finest members of AA who's had a lot of experience, a former staff secretary, alcoholic staff on our general service office, and she could talk for hours about phone calls, not only at home, but also in the office and letters, wanting to know how can you punish somebody in AA? How can you inflict damage on them? How can you throw them out? And all they do to say is this, all we can share is our experiences of other groups. That's all. Many, many years ago, in the early days, the members wrote Bill and said, Bill, we do not want a government. We will do anything you tell us to do. And so when they would write about a problem, they would write back and say, let us know how you consummate the problem, but please write us back and tell us how you did it so we can put it in our files so that when a similar group or a member of AA has that particular problem or a problem similar to it, we can share with them AA's experience. We cannot tell you what to do. We can just suggest as a result of experience. Not any more than our own personal stories when we're working with another alcoholic. And so, an AA happening for us, we found we need no human authority, whatever. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we've got two authorities. God as we understand Him, and alcohol as we understand Him. One heals, and the other kills. There's God, our Father, who simply say, here is my will through AA's principles. I'm giving it to you free to live my will. And the other authority is alcohol, and says, you better live God's will and use it or I'll kill you. And sometimes He does kill. So when the chips are down, we conform to God's will, or AA, and that's not, AA is nothing more than God's will for us as a recovering in AA. And you have to remember that not all members of not all alcoholics want Alcoholics Anonymous. They would like to have just to be free of alcohol, but they're not willing to take the recovery program. Why? Because it's painful. It's deflation of ego in and at depth. It forces us to start living new ideas and do something about the old ideas. We're warned about that in every meeting that they read a portion of chapter 5. And so as a result, and we conform when all the chips are down, we conform to God's will or we perish. And at that level, the death sentence hangs over the AA member, his group, and AA as a whole. So there's authority enough, there's love enough, and punishment enough, all without any human being grabbing the handles of power. And such is AA's backstop against dissolution, and its final guarantee of survival under any and all conditions. If AA did not operate and could consummate problems under any and all conditions, us drunks would have eaten this thing up alive long ago. So for us, it's to do or what? It's to die drunk. Tradition 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now the first tradition tells us what our common welfare is. Recovery from our illness as we understand it in AA. The second tradition, who's the boss? No human being governs Alcoholics Anonymous. The third tradition knocks out all requirements for membership other than the one thing, and that is stopping drinking alcohol one day at a time. The fourth tradition allows a group to be an AA group and not a BB group. You know what a BB group is? It ain't AA. That's all. It allows it the same freedom as a group, the same freedom for us to either come in here and do the deal and face the consequences or don't do the deal and face the consequences. And now that sets it up to where we can carry the only message that AA really has to offer to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now, every newcomer and some of us that have been around for a while have had to learn the hard way, because this business of staying sober must have top priority. And if we fail at that, we cannot succeed at anything else. And so our fifth tradition just simply reminds us that groups should remember their one primary purpose. And very often, unthinking enthusiasm puts a group off on the main track. One group in Alcoholics Anonymous, as an example, offered expanded AA programs that include helping newcomers find jobs. Now, Tradition 5 doesn't frown on the individual AA member who tells another about a good job, but when the group turns itself into an employment agency, the newcomer may get confused about the primary purpose. I've been in a lot of AA groups that meet more than once in the same facility, and you go in and they got a bulletin board. And I've been in a lot of them, you can't even find their meeting schedule, but they got everything else on their board. Jobs wanted, babysitting wanting, microwave raffle, cake raffle, all that. This is the one that tickles me, they'll put it up on the board. Roommate needed, must be at least 3 days sober, you know. Yeah. And it confuses a lot of people what AA is all about, you know. Now, AA's responsibility is to show an alcoholic how they can live sober. And then that member of AA can get himself a job, or he can quit his job. AA's not interested in whether we're working or not. No. Are we staying sober? Now, using discretion, a member may lend a few dollars needed for a meal or a room, or even invite a broke alcoholic to be a temporary guest in their home. You have never lived until you have invited a broke alcoholic to be a temporary guest in your home and they stay a year. I'll tell you, I had one of them, and good God Almighty, he wrecked Grace's car and he disappeared. I met him somewhere, I don't know, running around the country, and he come to Dallas and didn't have a place to stay, and our boys were already in the university and we had this empty bedroom, and I invited him to come over. I asked Grace first, okay, if he don't stay too long. Well, he disappeared. And one night there was a knock on my door. And there are two men standing there. Now, a policeman is a policeman is a policeman. I don't care if he's wearing long hair and designer jeans and chains around his neck, and he's got a circular cut in his hip pocket with his snuff tin and wearing snake boots, or whether he's got brush cut, haircut, mustache, smoking a pipe, white lyle socks, and hush puppies. They're all the same. And one of them had a long piece of paper, and one of them reached his coat, flashed out. There, policemen are born with an impediment. Out comes his picture and his badge number and everything, and he identifies them. We have a search warrant for your home, and we're looking for somebody. I said, who are you looking for? They told me. I said, he disappeared a few weeks ago, but in the bedroom he was living in the closet, he left two huge boxes. They're still sealed, and you can go in and look at them if you want to. So they go in and they open them up, and my God, there's ladies' jewelers in there, and there's transistor radios and a lot of other expensive stuff. And one of them looked at me and said, you don't know anything about this? I said, no. Are you sure you're not covering for him? You're not one of his accomplices? I said, I am very sure I am not. They said, well, you and these boxes, we're going to have to take you down to the jail. So they put me in the back seat of this squad car, and I'm laughing all the way down to the jail. Now, I'll tell you right now, it's a tremendous experience to go to jail while you're sober. I don't mind telling you that. And they take me there, and they take me to the night desk sergeant, and they explain everything, and they said, now, we found these boxes, and we're going to take them to the police property room, and we're going to have them inventoried, and maybe we can find their rightful owners. But we're going to leave him with you. They left. The desk sergeant, he just shook his head. He took his glasses off. He looked up at me and he said, "Sponsor, when are you going to learn?" Now, he knew all about this character. I'd already told him about it. He said, "Now, go on. Get out of here, you know?" And so, but even when acting on our own as an individual member, an AA layman certainly should not award himself an honorary medical degree and hand out diagnoses, prescriptions, and amateur analysis of other people's sicknesses. Now, because this exact personal failing is so common today in AA, the AA group should remember, in all of its dealings, it should be extra careful to emphasize that it is not invading the medical field. Only through the personal experiences of its members is it qualified to carry only one message: how an alcoholic can recover in AA. I'm going to share a very, very sad experience. There was a beautiful gal. At the time she was about 10 and a half, 11 years of age, she hit the streets. And she began drinking and using and doing all those things and got into a tremendous amount of problems and troubles. And she'd been in and out of adolescent units and in and out of adolescent detention homes. And it got to the point where mother and father, in total desperation, just total disowned her. That's it. And when she was about 23, 24 years of age, she was drunk and she was on other things. And she was driving one of those sports cars with a fiberglass body, the kind that'll do about 180 standing still. And she was driving out in the country about 145 miles an hour. And she missed a curve and hit a huge oak tree head on. And that fiberglass body just exploded like popcorn. She came through the windshield, and the top of her skull hit the trunk of the tree and just literally crushed it like jelly. Through some miracle, it did not kill her instantly. And they took her in, and after many hours of intensive brain surgery, and in many, many days and hours in intensive care, she laid there, totally paralyzed, didn't even know who she was or where she was. They called her parents. Her parents said, "We have no daughter. Do with her what you want to do." Well, she couldn't lay there. So they went before the county commissioner's court, and they had her committed for life in the lock ward of an insane asylum not too far from Dallas, Texas, a state institution. Now, a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous, we get a lot of mileage out of, you know, making fun of psychiatrists, you know, and those in the medical profession and those in the religious field. And particularly physicians, we blame them. They got us on this stuff and all this stuff and all that stuff. That's just a smokescreen. In that particular institution, there was a Cuban refugee psychiatrist who knew a lot about AA. Now, knowing about AA and knowing AA are two different things. He was not a member of AA. As he began to gather up this gal's past medical history, he began to suspicion that she may be an alcoholic. And if this be the case, the only chance she ever had to get a little bit better, the kind of medicine that they were given with those who are totally insane in a lock ward, wasn't it? That she needed to be over in the alcohol recovery unit of that institution to where our kind get the kind of love that we need if we're going to get well. And that's all that AA has to offer, and that's love. Love, with no conditions attached to it. So he went over and he talked to the people responsible for the ward over there, and they said, "Yes, but we'll have to go through the commissioner's court. We'll get her moved when you say she's ready." The day came when they went to the commissioner's court. They granted the freedom to move her over in the alcohol recovery unit. And she just laid there, totally paralyzed, didn't know who she was. But as the sober lady members of Alcoholics Anonymous came in to bring AA meetings, they became attached to her. Couldn't even remember how to wash her hair. They'd wash her hair. She couldn't even remember how to put on lipstick and rouge. They brought her some designer jeans and some pantyhose. And they started to pet her and they started to love her. And in a few weeks' time, her eyes opened. And she started to bloom just like a beautiful, dainty little flower that needs a lot of nourishment. We all feel that need when we get here. And then she'd been there around about 9 weeks. And the unit was startled. Here she was dragging that left side down the hallway, going and sitting down in the AA meeting. And about 3 weeks later, they heard her giggle. And a few weeks later, she held her hand up and gave her first name. And she was an alcoholic. The day came to where she could get a little bit well enough to where she could go out on the weekend, provided she had two sober lady members of Alcoholics Anonymous with her at all times. And they took her out and they brought her into Dallas and they took her around to AA meetings, and when they brought her back on Sunday evening, the last thing she said, and she was crying, she said, "If I ever get out of here, can I be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous?" Because she found some people who loved her. Her new family, new mothers and fathers and aunts and uncles, cousins. Yeah. And the day came to where she could be released, provided she had two sober lady members of Alcoholics Anonymous as sponsors at all time and two backups, plus a place to live. Well, they found her a little place to live, and she got a little part-time job, being part-time self-supporting through her own contributions, and she was a member of our group, and God, what a tremendous member she was. Nobody had to tell her to pick up styrofoam cups. Nuh-uh. She'd get down on the floor with paper toweling and wipe up where other members would spill coffee and wouldn't clean up, and she washed the ashtrays, and she would come early and wipe and the chairs and the tables. And God, she was tremendous. And then the great night came when it was in a closed discussion meeting to where everybody's an expert about everything and don't know nothing about nothing. And the topic for discussion that night, are you really sober if you're taking medication? Well, it got around to her, and she said, as a result of her massive brain damage, that she was subject to convulsions and seizures for the rest of her life. And in order to avoid such convulsions and seizures, she had to take a mild dosage of medicine plus some phenobarbital. Now, they've changed it, but in those days that were Dilantin and phenobarbital, which is the standard medication for those who suffer seizures and convulsions as a physical name, not as a result of a drink. Well, in order to stay alive. Well, the minute she said phenobarbital, three members of that group, one sober 5 years, one sober about 3 years, and one sober not quite a year, they took every inch of hide off of that gal. They said, "You're not sober, you're taking dope." And not knowing any different, because she had never been exposed to tradition meetings or the basic principles, she was too new, thinking they were going to throw her out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a court of last resort. It was her home, her family. In our group, we keep what we call sobriety cards. Being a large group, our name, and it's filed alphabetically, not by the first name or the last name, but the first name of the first letter of the first name, and our sobriety dates and our phone number, if we want to be called on 12-step calls and et cetera and et cetera. And usually your sponsor's name, provided your sponsor's sober. She went in and she asked for her sobriety card. She tore it up. She made out a new one. Her new sobriety day, it was that day. She went home, flushed all of her prescribed medication, which she was not abusing, down the commode. About 3 weeks later, she had a convulsion and a seizure, the kind that salt water and honey won't stop, Gatorade and honey won't stop, and she died. One of her sponsors called me, and she said, we called her parents and informed them what they wanted to do, and they said, nothing. At least they won't be hearing about her anymore. And then She said to me, "What are we going to do about a funeral?" I said, "Don't be concerned. We take care of our kind. She'll not only have a nice place to lay the rest of her life, and she'll have nice services." Then she asked me, "Well, who are we going to get for pallbearers?" And I said, "I know three." And coming back from the cemetery, the graveside services, the one that was 5 years sober asked me this question, "Where did we go wrong?" And I just simply quoted word for word from our fifth tradition in our illustrated tradition pamphlet. As it closes it out, it says, "The AA group, in all of its dealings, should be extra careful to emphasize that it is not invading the medical field. Through the personal experiences of our members, it is qualified to carry only one message, how an alcoholic can recover in AA." Now, those three members of AA, the one sober 5, the one sober almost 3, and one sober almost a year, none of them have ever had convulsions. None of them had ever had seizures. They heard. For those of you here this morning, when I started out, I said, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we ask to share our experiences and not our opinions. Because we find as a result of our experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that opinions, in many, many instances, have a tendency to make sick people sicker, and in some instances to physically kill people. That is exactly what I'm talking about. Now, that is not an isolated case. It's happening right this second in Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world. I'll give you another actual experience. Same group, at a noon meeting. The chairman of that meeting, it was a closed discussion meeting, opened it up and started World War VIII and said, "Well, has anybody got anything they want to talk about today?" And they did. And they got to talking about feelings. And they got to talking about inner child. Now, I don't know about you, but the only human being that I knows 100% what an inner child is, and that's a pregnant woman. Now, they know what an inner child is. The inner child. They got to talking about everything in this world. And there were three members of Alcoholics Anonymous in there that were suffering from grave emotional and mental disorders. And they wanted to talk to someone. You know, what am I going to do about this? They were talking about everything in this world. That meeting was an hour meeting over at 1 o'clock. By 9 o'clock that evening, all three of them had committed suicide. They went home more depressed and more sicker than they were when they were. And they took their own diagnosis, which was instant death by their own hand, which is sanity. Sanity. We have a wonderful step in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. What kind of sanity? To have sense enough to realize that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable, and an unmanageable life is trying to manage a situation that an unmanageable life can't manage. And being powerless over alcohol will only be able to manage one thing 100%, and that's take a drink of alcohol. You know, some groups, you know, tried to take over all the alcoholism information in the area, and the temptation is understandable, and it was even stronger when at the time this tradition was written, because public ignorance about alcoholism as an illness was more widespread than it is now. Since then, other agencies have sprung up to assume the job of educating the general public about alcoholism. Education and educating the public about alcoholism is not AA's purpose. Ours is to inform the public about what AA is and what AA is not. But these agencies are also trying to help the active alcoholic. Thank God. They are our friends. And Tradition 6 establishes the boundaries of those relationships of cooperation. Tradition 6, an AA group will never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise unless problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. So traditions 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 maintain a group to carry its only message that it knows, how an alcoholic can recover in AA. Now, the related facility may be an outside group combating alcoholism or an enterprise that AA's wanted to start, and it was the latter. AA's wanted to start in the early days that most confronted our young fellowship, and you know what? Even today it still confronts our fellowship, especially with all the trust money and tax-free money and grant money that's available today. Government money used to be, but government money has run out. It has absolutely run out. And back in the old days, it was about 1890, I forget actually, the time when the huge Javits Bill first came in, and God, they started government funding for halfway houses and for treatment for drunks and other things, and you know what I mean? And as a result of it, little members of AA, all of a sudden, they were leaving AA. And you'd walk into one of them and say, I haven't seen you at the group, or immediately, David, I'm a 7. Well, what's a 7? Well, that's a pay scale. I'm working for the United States government today. David, all my life, that's all I've ever wanted to be is an alcoholism counselor. I said, what? Yeah, I said, how long are you sober? 2 years. Well, it took you 20 years to admit you're an alcoholic. You're sober 2 years, and all your life, that's all you've ever wanted to be is an alcoholism counselor. Well, a lot of them thought because they made a few 12-step calls and sponsored a few, that qualified them for that. So the treatment modalities today to defend their own self and getting our kind of egos in that deal, they had to start a certification program for them, not for us. And a lot of little drunks got involved in it, and it was too heady a wine for them. Some made it back, but a lot of them never made it back, you know, and they're drunk. And back in the old days, the old Alcoholic Association Foundation, you know, they thought that Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, should heal everybody and educate everybody and bring them anybody they want to at AA and throw them out of AA, you know. And then they got into lawsuits and everything else, you know. And as a result of it, things were getting tough. Now, a lot of those ambition centers fail. Some individual members have since founded some very successful clubhouses, rest farms, halfway houses. We've got more halfway houses, 3/8-inch houses, half-inch houses, quarter-inch houses, than you can shake a stick at. They just taper a drunk down, you know, just like you taper off a drunk or taper back on them. Now, these enterprises are run by members of AA and patronized by other members, our prospective members, but money and property are involved. Therefore, due to AA's proven experience, wise by our own experience, to keep the operation of the facility completely separate from that of any AA group, and to keep the names like the First Step House, the Fourth Step House, the Third Step House, the 12th Step House out of the name. Now, towards outside agencies dealing with alcoholism, the AA policy is cooperation but not affiliation. Now, a group cooperates. We all know that, for example, by welcoming referrals from treatment modalities, hospitals, correctional institutions, or by sponsoring AA-type meetings in institutions. But in one area, money for a rehabilitation house was solicited in AA meeting applying affiliation. It certainly did. In another area of our country, AA was listed among beneficiaries of a United Fund drive. Now, AA members employed by outside agencies wear two hats, but Tradition 6 cautions any such member against wearing both hats at once. It's impossible for an alcoholic to wear two hats at the same time. It's real simple. We haven't got but one head. That's it. On the job, he or she may be an alcoholism counselor, but he or she is not an AA counselor. There's no such thing as an AA counselor, AA housewife, AA single, AA doctor, AA dentist, AA lawyer, AA bum, AA plumber, AA bank robber, AA carpenter. We haven't got one kind of AA, and that is a member. Period. That's all. At meetings, he or she is just a member of AA and not an alcoholism expert. So today we understand and accept the paradox that the more AA sticks to its primary purpose, the greater will be its helpful influence everywhere. Now, you know, we're all perfectionists, and after failing at perfection, We'd gone to the other extreme and settled for the bottle in the blackout. Then Providence, through Alcoholics Anonymous, has brought us within reach of our highest expectations. So it became good reason with this kind of thinking, why shouldn't we share our life with everyone? Well, we share our life with everyone. Our 12th step tells us this. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So every life that we touch, we share with everyone, if we're living within the confines of those principles. Well, in the early days, they tried AA hospitals, and they all folded because you cannot put an AA group in the business. You got too many busybodies mess up the formula. If you've got a group and you've got 60 members in your group, you've got 60 dictators. And no dictator wants to be a second-class dictator, you know? And then AA groups tried their hand at education. And when they began to publicly drumbeat the merits of this or that brand, people became confused. They started asking questions, and serious questions. Did AA fix drunks, or was it an educational project? Was AA spiritual, or was it religious? Was it medical, or was it witchcraft? Was it a reform movement? So in utter confusion and disgust, AA found itself getting married to all kinds of enterprises, some good, but most of them not so good. Then some AA groups started hounding legislators for legal reform in this business of committing drugs to prisons and asylums. In those days, it made good newspaper reading, but little else. And we might as well face it today. The judicial system in both the United States and Canada are very, very concerned about the same problem drinker showing back up in front of the same judge time and again after the judge, so-called, has sentenced them to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it is not the group's responsibility or the group's secretary to sign court papers, committed papers, when they come to meetings. No, it certainly isn't. Because it is not the group to reveal who comes to AA and who doesn't come to AA. But if an individual member wants to sign it, that's up to their freedom. However, I'm going to share some actual experiences with you. There have been some who have come to AA meetings, gotten their court-committed papers signed. Usually a lot of them have the date, the name of the group, the topic discussed, if the group has a phone number, etc., and a signature for the chairperson or and a member of the group. They have left those meetings, went immediately to a bar or somewhere and started drinking, and were picked up and brought before the judge again. And the judge says to them, actually through their counseling officer or probation officer, and he said, I thought I had sentenced you to so many meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he pulls out the paper and said, here it is. I went to the meeting last night. But judge, you sent me to a place it doesn't work for me. Now, on that piece of paper, then it becomes a part of the public record. Not only is the offense for that problem drinker being apprehending his probation, but I've been drinking, but also the name of the AA group, the location, the name of whoever member of AA who signed it, and et cetera, and et cetera. And there's been some instances to where that offender, getting himself legal counsel to be represented, and the legal counsel has got the court to subpoena every name that was on that list. That is the fragility of it. You say, well, now what is the solution? It's real simple. How come they've never asked the judge or their probation officer to come and sit in AA meetings with them and see with their own eyes whether they're there or not? I suspicion that some probation officers and judges don't want to come because they may suspicion that they may have a problem also, you know. Yeah. Yeah. What do they have to fear? What do they have to fear? That's all. That's all. However, court-committed programs have been very, very successful in my mind. If one offender takes the bait and begins to live sober and in turn carries the message, the whole program is worth, provided it works within the confines of our spirit, of our traditions, cooperation, but not affiliation. I have yet to see the failure and breakdown of anyone's successes in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what a successful member of Alcoholics Anonymous is? That's the one that dies sober. That is a successful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yes. But we measure success in other areas because of the society and the way we used to live, you know what I mean? And so as a result of it, you know, and then AA got mired itself in politics. So they experienced then in Plain a deep-rooted conviction that in no circumstances could we endorse any related enterprise, no matter how good. We of AA cannot be all things for all men and women, nor should we try. Then, this is one of my favorites. Then there was an AA member who thought about taking a public relations job with a large distilling company to educate the public about why alcoholics should not consume alcohol. Now, everybody knows why an alcoholic should not consume alcohol except the alcoholic. But this liquor distilling corporation wanted the member to use his name in all of its advertising, and he was to be described as its director of publicity and as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there couldn't be the slightest objection if such a corporation, liquor corporation, hired an AA member solely because of his public relations ability and his knowledge about alcoholism, but that was not the whole story. Because in this particular instance, not only was an AA member to break his anonymity to the public level, he was to link the AA name to this particular education project, to this particular distillery in the minds of millions of people. Now, I'll share with you how this alcoholic's head thinks. I'm sitting there and I'm watching television. And during the commercial break, here comes this handsome-looking man, his hair all blowed out, got on one of them new double-breasted suits, you know, with a tie on it. Looks like somebody threw up all over it, you know. And he says, he gives his full name. And he says, I'm an alcoholic and a member of AA, and I'm the director of publicity and the educational project of this distilling company. Well, my head says, David, the most popular brand that distilling corporation distills is Old Buzzard. Now, David, if you drink Old Buzzard, you're not going to be an alcoholic because he works for that company, and that company recommends Old Buzzard. That's how this alcoholic thinks. And so do a heck of a lot of others think that way. Well, as a result of it, you know, after coming to his senses, well, he really didn't come to his senses. His group knocked some sense in his head. He went to the group and he said, I have got the finest job that anybody could have, and I'm going to make myself $65,000 a year. They said, doing what? And he told them. They said, hey, wait a minute. Before you got sober for 5 years, before you got sober, you were unemployable. And you laid around here whining and crying for 4 years that nobody would hire you. And now because you're sober, you're going to get this job, you know, and you're going to violate every principle that kept AA open so you could come in and become a useful, productive citizen in this world of living. And then that member realized that AA saved his life and its principles had to come first. And he said to himself, he certainly did not want to be the guy to land AA in big-time trouble. And this he would certainly do it. So concerning endorsements. See, actual experiences are so much better than just reading out of the book and memorizing the book. Digging into the things for all of these things that happen, you know. Concerning endorsements. Our member friend had said it all. We was as never before. Could we not lend the A name to any cause other than our own? So we now know from our own experience that the more AA minds its own business, the greater general influence would become. Medicine, religion, and psychiatry, and the business world at large have begun to borrow many, many of our ideas as a result of our experience. All the things that AA wanted to do in the early days came about as a result of us minding our own business and the general public seeing the success of the singleness of purpose. It has directed other self-help groups to the singleness of purpose, and that's where they have their successes as a result of AA's experience. Now, we didn't do this because we are so great. We did it to save our lives so that we wouldn't go back to drinking. AA has come about because we exhausted our alternatives. It was either do or to die. Now, so has research, rehabilitation, education, all sorts of therapeutic groups have sprung up. They have approximately 250 some odd self-help peer groups that use what we call the AA method. They deal with gambling and divorce and delinquency and dope addiction, mental illness, parents with partners, parents without partners, weight reduction, and eating disorders, any kind of disorder that you got in this world, and every kind of dysfunction that you got, and the like. They work their own fields, and we do not have to endorse them or tell them how to live. Our influence has not only been confined just to these fields. It has become general. It's cropping out in political and business life. People who know alcoholics and their families are deeply affected. The very developments AA once wanted to force upon the public have begun to take place by themselves. One recurring problem faced by AAs who try to carry the message into treatment facilities is the proliferation of non-alcoholic drug addicts in these facilities. Often the guidelines for attendance to these patients at AA meetings are very, very unclear, which leads to complications on the part of AA members who try to carry the AA message. Now, AA's policy regarding non-alcoholic drug addicts is usually unknown to treatment facilities. And it is utterly amazing because many, many who work for pay in treatment facilities happen to be members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And therefore, committee members and individual members of AA find themselves in the position of having to educate professionals in this matter. Some treatment facilities are inclined to view all substance abusers and alcoholics as having the same common addictions, and therefore they are treated accordingly. Now, treatment facilities may have sufficient and valid reasons for employing these approaches during the treatment process. However, AAs who carry the message into treatment facilities often find that non-alcoholic addicts are encouraged by the facilities to attend AA meetings within the facilities. In addition, because of the effectiveness of the AA program in providing post-treatment support to alcoholics, non-alcoholic drug addicts are often referred by treatment facilities to AA and AA meetings when they leave treatment facilities. In such cases, the practices of a treatment facility is clearly at odds with AA traditions. Now, you have to remember, our traditions are not treatment facilities' traditions. Now, AA singleness of purpose must be communicated to the administrators and staff of treatment facilities by the treatment facility committee or any experienced, knowledgeable member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, the treatment facility committees have the task of informing and educating these professionals about AA policy and traditions. AA meetings within a treatment facility cannot be substance abuse meetings. They are held for alcoholics only, including duly addicted alcoholics. I'm talking about non-alcoholic addicts is what I'm talking about. Now, although enlightening treatment facility personnel on the reasons for abiding by AA's policy and traditions on this matter is often difficult and very, very time-consuming, our experience has shown us that the most effective communication by AA's is done in a loving manner and in the spirit of cooperation. Those are not my words. Those words are from page 83 of our conference-approved treatment facility workbook, which is a composite of AA's experience, not just in one locality or in one group, but the entire North America from our North American General Service Conference. Tradition 7. AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. You know, we have to be practical. A group can hardly hold its meeting on a street corner, and an empty basket would not fill a coffee pot. But as soon as we become active, we learn how many expenses are involved in making meetings effective. Then our horizons broaden. What about that inner group or central office so many of us call to ask for help? Phone companies do not give free service. They are so thankful that we're sober and not trying to call long distance and dig up the Ayatollah. I have a tremendous, tremendous relationship with the phone company. They have let me know that as long as I pay my phone bill, the phone service will continue. And when I quit paying it, they'll cut the service off. Now, that's what you call an understanding. Yeah. Then our horizons broaden. And beyond our own locality, we'll learn about the AA General Service Office and the responsibility and the work it does for groups everywhere. AA activity is self-supporting or ought to be at all levels, and in every case, the responsibility comes right back to us as individual and collective members, for we are Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous belongs to the members. It's a gift to our members. Now, sometimes when we're new, our contributions rattle rather than rustle. Now, you know, there are very, very few groups when they pass the basket, they don't pass an empty 2-pound coffee can around because you put a quarter in and go plump. I could tell when a quarter went in and when a half a dollar went in, you know. But when we put a dollar in, it just slides down and it's very silent. And I used to sit next to what was reputed to be not only one of the wealthiest members of Alcoholics Anonymous financially, but also one of the wealthiest and financial human beings in the world. And I used to sit with him, and he'd wear them $2,000 suits, and he had on a diamond ring about the size of the headlight on a locomotive, and he'd smoke one of them $3 cigars, and he'd wear them $1,000 shoes, and I really started sitting by him because I thought maybe I could fleece him out of something one of those days. And when the basket would come around, I'd put my little dollar in, and he'd reach in his pocket, and he'd pull out an old-fashioned peddler's purse that was folded over, and I never will forget, it had three rubber bands on it. He'd take the rubber bands, and he'd set them meticulously, and it'd open up about this. I had three snaps, and the middle snap was the master snap. He'd undo it, and that allowed the one on the right to open up, and he'd reach in, and he'd manipulate like he's working a puppet, and he'd pull out a quarter, and he'd put a quarter in the basket, and I put my dollar in there, and here's this multi-millionaire, about a billionaire, putting a quarter in, and I used to get resentful every time at every meeting. It never occurred to me to go sit somewhere else to where I never could watch him. But I enjoyed that resentment. I enjoyed that resentment. And one night I was particularly resentful. They talked about the group needing a little money. And I put in $2 that night. And he put in that same quarter. And at the meeting, my eyes were wild. And my sponsor caught me. And that's one of the reasons we look in each other's eyes and shake each other's hands. It tells us a lot about each other. And he saw those wild eyes. He says, "What's wrong with you, animal?" I said, "That man, he's not only one of your business partners, but tonight I put in $2. Y'all asked for money for the group, and he put in that same quarter." My sponsor looked at me and he said, "David, Where did you get those two $1 bills you put in the basket tonight? I dropped my head and I looked up at him. I said, I wrote another hot check today. He said, David, AA doesn't need that kind of money, and it does not want that kind of money. And furthermore, the one that you're getting mad and resentful for has helped more people in AA and out of AA anonymously than you'll ever help if you live to be 280 years old and earn $10 billion. Now shut up, and I don't want to ever catch you doing that again. And if you don't like what he's doing, you come sit with me. That's exactly what he told me. That's what you call love and understanding. Because it was the truth. Absolutely the truth.